You know, some people enjoy composing their own music, chord by chord, and others are happiest when they come across that one perfect song. Work is not a lot different than that. Whether you prefer building your own workflow or using a pre-made template, with Monday.com, you and the team can work in a way that's comfortable for everyone. Tap the banner to go to Monday.com and build your own amazing workflow, or find an awesome template. No judgment.
Seven of his victims had to give evidence in court. That is an ordeal in its own right. To give evidence in a court that was absolutely bursting with people, when you take into account the press, family of victims, supporters of Baker, members of the public, those victims had to go into the witness box and relive their very worst nightmare.
At first, I was so wrapped up with actually getting there without falling over and actually sitting down and answering questions and stuff that I'd forgotten that he was even there. And then suddenly there was a pause in the questioning and I looked over and I was really, really surprised. I thought I would recognise him instantly. I thought there would be no doubt in my mind at all. And when I saw him, it wasn't like that. He just looked perfectly ordinary, just like anybody you could meet in the street.
When I saw him, it was just this person I'd never seen before that had done this to me. It was just this feeling of total hatred. He was just a sad, lonely man there. Yet, just normal.
A disc jockey has been found guilty at the Old Bailey of three rapes and a number of other sexual offences. Police believe that Richard...
What makes someone like Baker what he is, behave the way he has? I don't know. It's a mixture of nature, nurture. But he has exercised a choice in attacking the women in the way he did. He exercised a choice when he forced victims to give evidence in court. He will always be in a position to exercise a choice. The responsibility must be his.
If I could say something to Richard now, it would be, I know how close we were, and I know we had some bloody good times, we had some really good times, but I had to do it. Somebody had to stop him, and unfortunately it was me.
I was struck by Baker's ordinariness when I first saw him in the cell block, and I think the lesson really for all of us is that there are no monsters. There are only ordinary people who do monstrous things.
Hey, lovely listeners, and welcome back to Crime Analyst in the Intelligence Cell. This week, I'm continuing my conversation with Sam, and we'll take you behind the scenes of a high-profile and highly pressured linked investigative rape series codenamed Operation Monarch. In this episode, you'll hear for the first time the detailed analytical and investigative work that went into catching a very dangerous, prolific and violent serial rapist within just a few months. We're going to dive back in where we left off in part one. And just to jog your memory, I was talking about the comparative case analysis that I undertook and the granular behavioural analysis of the offender's mood and demeanour and any changes across the time the offender interacted with the victim. Without further ado, let's rejoin this illuminating conversation about what it really takes to be an operational criminal behavioural analyst working a high-profile linked rape series across multiple police services. In this particular series, he would start off with the threat, but then he would start, once he had them under control, he would start to talk. He was a talker, and he would share all this intimate information, but then he would want intimate information from them, and he would want them to participate. Then when he felt that they did, that it was a consensual encounter, and he'd say things like, oh, you must feel really bad now.
Yeah, yes.
He totally felt that that he had persuaded them that this was consensual encounter. So then I would look at the sexual acts and break down the sequencing of them, the themes, any sexual problems, any dysfunctions, any loss of erection, what was happening at the time. And those sexual acts, I mean, that again, with this particular individual, it was pages long because he would spend time with the victim. So the micro detail, and of course, sexual violence, it's worth just pointing out, is power and control related.
Yeah. And this individual really wanted them to participate, but he wanted them to be the ones that were dominating and leading him. That was his fantasy. So again, with a lot of the sexual acts, I would look to fantasy-led behavior and scripting and role-playing and things in micro detail.
And it's also about competence as an offender, isn't it? There's not just one sexual act. If there's several or it's layered and it goes between sexual acts, the victim has to be controlled in a different way for each one of those to occur. So that shows, you know, once again, that there's a level of competence, or that they've thought it through, or that they've been able to achieve that before, therefore they're exerting it on this occasion as well.
Absolutely. And he would say that he wanted them to masturbate, not in every case, but in a number of them, and that he wanted them to ejaculate, which was a very unusual expression.
Yes, I remember that now. Yes, very true.
I don't think I've ever heard it across a series where a man says to the victim, you are going to ejaculate, I want you to ejaculate. So the language choice is very important.
Yeah, I think it's the only time I've heard it.
Yes, so that it becomes much more significant. I worked another series where it was little boys who were being abducted. It was a cops area, a cut through that schoolboys were using. And this very prolific perpetrator, this was early on in my career, would force fellatio, and he would say to them, suck it like a straw. And in each case, I mean, that's very specific. I've never heard it across any other series, any other offense. And I've worked thousands and thousands of cases, and yet I saw it in, I think it was about 10 of them, where that same phrase was used. So that, again, for court, that can be very significant.
Yeah.
And every case is different, but you look for really the nuanced detail of the themes. And for example, with this particular perpetrator, towards the end, he would go into that poor me syndrome. You know, and in one of the actual offences, it's a North London one, he actually said his name by mistake. And I felt that that was an unconscious utterance. That was leakage. And it turned out to be his name. So he kind of forgot where he was then. Then I looked at closure, and it was in the closure that he had said his name. I look at how the offender decamps, what instructions he's giving to the victim. It could be count to 500, or turn away, don't use your phone, or I know where you live. And if you talk to the police, I'll be watching you. And that's what this individual did. In a number of the offences, he would say, I know where you live, I'm watching you. If you report me, I will come back and kill you. And so each victim thought long and hard about whether they report. And then I would look at the offender's description, and that would include things like accent. In fact, one of the victims, and it's the North London offence again, the victim was incredible. She remembered such micro detail, and she said his accent was rural. Now, what's interesting is that she was correct. He did have a rural accent, but age and height and smells, you know, we know through when you're going through a horrific and traumatic encounter, your senses are hyper alert, and particularly your sense of smell. So that can be quite important, where you've got similar things being said, but looking at the ethnicity, build, eyes, nose, face, hands, any special markings, tattoos, so forth, clothing, or anything else that the victim remembers about the perpetrator. And again, with this individual, there were lots of things specific to him. And actually, the descriptions were pretty good in terms of their accuracies.
Yes, they were.
Which again is, it's unusual.
Yeah, I think, but part of that potentially plays into the fact that the victims were very close to him in age. The next instance that we'll talk about, there was a big disparity between the ages, but actually, as we now come to know that obviously it is Richard Baker, that he was fairly close to a few. I imagine some of the girls were very young, weren't they?
They were 15 to 35 of in terms of years of age that we know about.
Yeah. And he sort of sat in the middle of that range.
Yes. But he did target young schoolgirls, you know, although it was at night. And we know that he went out stalking girls and women in what we would call now target rich environments, hunting grounds. For example, Southend, very busy. I'll share what he said at court because there's some very interesting things. So the sexual acts I look to, and these are other headings that I have, fantasy, possible indicators of fantasy. in terms of victim participation, for example, or souvenir taking, trophy taking, indications of flashings, other paraphilias. And a paraphilia is really anything that is outside the normal, in inverted commas, script of being aroused. And of course, that is incredibly
wide.
Yes, and it's quite subjective at times.
Yeah, very, very.
Yeah. But what are the sexual themes that keep coming up? And an example, as I've already said, was that he would want the victims to participate. He would want them to masturbate. He would tell them to position themselves in certain sexual positions. He would ask them about if they had a partner or a husband and if they enjoyed those positions. He wanted to know real detail as part of his fantasy and part of his control, and that aroused him further. And again, just to make the point that when we're talking about sexual arousal, this individual was all about power and control and dominating the victim, because that, again, was something that came up at court. But I also look at the offence site. So the encounter, the approach, the attack, the release, they can all be different environments. So that's important. Of course, if we're talking about murder, then you might have a different body deposition site to where they were actually attacked and killed and that might be different again from where they were approached. So if the victim was moved, we want to know about that. Planning is another heading. Possible indicators, so things like rape kits or rape outfits or bindings being brought, weapons being brought, condoms being brought, familiarity with the victim. This individual claimed that he knew some of the victims. He claimed the North London victim, he had seen her at work and he wanted to talk to her, but he wasn't confident enough. Well, that was a lie. But so we have to look at these things, don't we, Sam, and know that they may not be truthful utterances. They could be used to mislead. So we have to weigh up everything that's said and whether we think it's truthful or not. And then I look at criminal behaviour as well. So verbal indications regarding concern for interruption, so that someone's scanning the environment, they're aware that they have to control the victim, maybe take them to a secondary location, cutting off the victim's sight so they don't see the perpetrator, which is what this perpetrator did. Whether it's verbal concern, masking, blindfolding, fingerprint precautions, i.e. wearing gloves or being careful about handling things, semen destruction, and whether it's an attempt to destroy or condom and possible lies to mislead or a false accent being used. I always look at the criminal types of behaviours that tell us about potential forensic sophistication, forensic awareness and criminal sophistication. And then I would code up actions and speech. So speech was always very important right from the start of my analysis, and I would group them. So the behaviours, the actions and the speech, and I would group them into intimate behaviours, criminal and or aggressive. And I would look at where an offender might lie. So the intimate behaviour are things like, I'll just give some examples of what I would look to. I would look to an excuse for why they're saying that they're doing this. So women lead men on, and it's because my wife is pregnant, and it's because my wife cheated on me. You know, these sorts of things, a sad tale, or I now call it PMS, poor me syndrome, which I coined in 2019. Any remorse. So this individual, this very prolific perpetrator with the North London victim, he showed remorse. You know, I suppose you don't, you know, this is the worst thing that could happen. You won't want to be with me. It's probably the worst thing I can say to you. I'll go to prison for this. I don't want to go back to prison. So we knew.
And this is the same victim that he gave his real name to?
Yes.
Yeah. So, I mean, she's definitely, that's a standout incident, isn't it? In terms of there were slight changes in the behaviour there.
He spent a lot of time with her. And that's why I always said this index offence is really important. She meant something to him by the end of it. And, you know, he did apologise to her. He complimented her. He reassured her that he wouldn't do it again. So I'm using her case. And for me, it was 15 pages of analysis, just of laying out what I'm talking about now, the comparative case analysis and detailing it. He said these revelations, you know, about problems with his family and finances, and that there were these two other sexual offences he'd committed in Oxford. Well, it wasn't Oxford, it was Southend. He asked inquisitive questions. This, again, is under intimacy seeking. Okay, so it's not intimacy, but he's seeking it. He treated her like it was a normal sexual encounter. He told her to look after herself, told her to promise him that she would take the bus from now on, kissed her on the cheek, and he flippantly patted her on the bottom when he left. He was trying to build rapport with her, and he wanted affection from her because he was kissing her. Now, you don't always get that with perpetrators. He was also aggressive when he needed to be to gain control at the start, but not aggressive throughout once he had control. And then the criminal, I had many bullet points around criminal, that he ensured his own personal safety, didn't want the victim to see his face, forcing her to close her eyes, putting a jacket over her head, trying to destroy the semen. He lied to mislead on many occasions. The theft was a ruse. He didn't take any money, but that was the ruse. And he was very conscious of fingerprints, and he wanted to ensure a safe departure for himself, even though it was a risky location. Well, the underpass in Southend was a very risky location, and it didn't matter that the boyfriend was in front of her. The knowledge of police and the legal system, talking about prisons, rehabilitation programs, he said that they don't work. So it gave me a very clear steer. He most likely had previous history, right?
Big indication.
Yeah. And he referenced the victim reporting, asking her not to report it, asked her, would she report it? She said she didn't know.
Oh, did she? That's interesting.
Yes, she did say she didn't know whether she would report it or not. She really said that she was in two minds. And actually, the only reason she did, she thought that she can compartmentalize it and she would just get on with her life when she got home. What really irked her was that he could harm other women. And that's why I just think women are just incredible, because for her, that was her driving force, to ensure that he didn't harm others.
You know, going back and looking at these two linked series, the courage of these women and girls, you know, for the next link series we're going to talk about, girls as young as 10, the courage and their ability to recall detail, you know, just in terms of providing the information that gave us the ability to then link them, I take my hats off to them. They are incredible, incredible women who have been through something utterly traumatic and want to protect others. What an incredible set of women.
Absolutely. There are so many benefits of microdosing, and all sorts of people are microdosing to feel healthier and perform better. Microdose gummies deliver perfect entry-level doses of THC that help you feel just the right amount of good. And who doesn't want that in life? I love how helpful these gummies are. For me, half a microdose gummy on the weekend helps me stay centered and fresh as I work out and get everything done on my weekend to-do list. One gummy, about 30 minutes before I go to bed, helps me relax at night and really be present in the moment, instead of worrying about things from that day or thinking about what's coming tomorrow. Get 30% off your first order, plus free shipping today at microdose.com, promo code CRIMEANALYST. It's available nationwide. That's microdose.com, promo code CRIMEANALYST, for 30% off and free shipping. Microdose.com, promo code CRIMEANALYST.
Sick of being upsold at gyms?
My guy, you're currently a base member. For $90 more, I can upgrade you to our Shred membership. For $130 more, you'll be a swole member. And for just $300 more, you'll reach Sweat Platinum.
At Planet Fitness, you'll get energy without the upsell. Never pushy, always free fitness training and equipment for every workout. It's fitness that fits your budget. Join Planet Fitness for just $1 down and $10 a month. Cancel anytime. Deal ends Friday, May 10th. See Home Club for details.
We're not naming the victims, and that's important too, but they are just, each of them were just incredible in wanting to ensure that others were protected. I really just can't underline that enough. And once they knew they were one of a number, they felt even more, a stronger resolve to ensure this individual was caught. But when it came to us catching him, to giving evidence and making sure that he got a very long sentence. And so from linking these offences, that was really critical. I remember going to the briefing at Cannon Row when Commander Paddy Tompkins took charge, because I had found these other offences. And I won't go through each of them, but there were another six offences I believe was him. And like I said, a number of them then came back on DNA. Five of them then came back on DNA. And that was prior. And I had to present to Paddy Tompkins and to a number of other people who were there at Cannon Row with Simon Wells, who we both know, my findings and why I believe these offences were linked. The commander was satisfied that they were linked, and then the forensics came in. And in fact, your SIO, Alan Ladley, was sat at the table as well. There is a little video that I've seen, I think you sent it to me, Sam, of a Crime Watch video, and actually it shows that Cannon Row meeting, but actually it's completely wrong of what they depict. The people around the table, some of them were there, but some of them weren't. I was there, and yes. I wasn't included in that.
Oh,
and
it's irksome, isn't it? Is it not irksome when that happens?
Particularly when you're the one giving the briefing with Simon Wells and your knees are knocking. And, you know, I remember saying to Simon just before we went in, because I'm relatively young in my career here, and I'm saying to Simon, I'm really nervous. And he said, you know, Laura, it's good to be nervous. I always remember him saying that the day you're not nervous is the day you need to leave the job. You should always be bringing your A game, and a little bit of nerves is a good thing to keep you on your toes. And he was one of my mentors. He was someone who I looked up to, and that really gave me reassurance. And I did go in. Simon and I gave the briefing. They were satisfied that these offences were linked. So that was November the 30th, 1998.
Yes.
And I know this because I keep everything, and particularly when I end
up... I'm glad you have.
Yeah, I mean, you know, it's important for the history. Otherwise, you get written out. And I have been many, many times. But the facts stand that November the 30th, we had a very productive meeting. And actually, it was agreed that there would be a media strategy to go on Crime Watch. And that would be in December. And these linked offences would be talked about in Crime Watch, and we would appeal to people who may know this very prolific offender. And I think we were all in no doubt that this guy was incredibly prolific, and there would be many more victims, past and future, and we wanted to make sure he was caught immediately. And I still remember what happened, Sam, that Crime Watch, Paddy Tompkins went to the studio, everyone was teed up. I think I was still, I think I was at New Scotland Yard. I knew that everything that was about to happen was so important in terms of getting the right information out. But actually, there was a call before Crime Watch happened that came
there
in.
Was.
Do you remember this?
Yeah, I do, because I was one of the team manning the phones in the FIB in Sussex. We didn't make it up to the lofty heights of the Crime Watch. Well, obviously, some of Anna Nadley, I can't remember if we did or not, but we were manning the phones because obviously phone lines went out for the various incident rooms.
Yes.
And a telephone call comes into the, I'll let you pick it up, because this is, you're the lead on this case, but a telephone call is made before Crime Watch started, isn't it?
Before it started, right before the live. And it was Alan Ladley who got the call. So your SIO, it was actually the brother of the offender who called him in, who had been plotting up the attacks and knew his brother, was very close to his brother, and ended up giving the name of Richard Baker and said he had a girlfriend in Sussex and he had previous for rape. And importantly, he was leaving that night to go to Spain.
Yes.
And that's when pressure came on, because, and I remember this.
Huge pressure.
And he was down in Devon, they believed, at the time. The brother felt that he was
at Bodmin, wasn't he?
In Bodmin, yes. That he was in Bodmin. And there was then a whole load of calls behind the scene. Paddy Tompkins ended up having to make some difficult decisions of how do we plan an arrest strategy when we don't know 100% that it's him. But yet, if he leaves the country, then the extradition process would just be a disaster. And I remember some Met officers charging off to Devon and Essex police doing the same. There was this bun fight between the forces. Everyone wanted to nick him, but the decision had to be taken. Well, what are you nicking him for? What are you arresting him for? And it was David Bright who kept pressing on the extradition issue. If he went on his toes to Spain, as that was always the talk, wasn't it? If
someone goes on his toes.
Then it's going to be impossible to get him back. And officers went down to Devon and Cornwall, and then it was understood that he'd got on a bus and that he was on a bus going up to Heathrow Airport. And a number of Met officers then decided to divert and go to Heathrow, the airport bus terminal, they didn't even know what he looked like. So they didn't know, you know, what he would look like getting off of the, or what the coach number was, what the bay was, et cetera. And it was, a decision was taken that he would be arrested for attempted rape and indecent assault. And of course, there was a huge onus on getting his DNA. And then he ended up coming off of one of those buses and he was met by two plainclothes detectives who asked him if he was Richard Baker. He was really surprised to be stopped and questioned. And then he was arrested and his DNA was taken and it matched with our linked series. So it was a huge relief to arrest this individual. It's very emotional as well, because it really, this case, I mean, it put the fear of God into women and to me, to all of us who worked on the job, right? It was really scary what he was doing.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, it's like you say, I think we were both very young in our careers there. And I learned such an enormous amount on, you know, an enormous amount in this job. And trying to intervene and arrest before someone gets on the plane. I don't know how familiar your listeners are with the extradition process, but it was absolutely the right call, because if you do have to extradite someone back to the UK, they have to arrive back in that UK. You're not allowed to interview them. They have to be charged. So then the case against, you know, it's even more difficult to kind of build and present the case, because an offender has to come into the country and be charged. You've got no legal right to talk to them, to interview them at all. So you don't get a second bite of that cherry. You know, it has to be locked down and firm. So it was the right decision to make sure he didn't get on that plane.
Thank goodness for the brother. And it's a very difficult call for a loved one, but he did the right thing, because to protect other women, he did the right thing. And I know that he felt real anxiety about losing the relationship with his brother, but he knew it was the right thing to do. And had we not have got that call, I mean, it was heralded as a Crime Watch success, but actually it wasn't. It was the brother who was just incredible. And Richard Baker ended up being charged with 21 offences. 21 offences. And that's what we knew about. And that's where the NC National Crime Faculty, I worked with them looking, we're still looking for other offences. And I was asked to put together the court report, which is a whole different process, particularly when we talk about comparative case analysis. And my heading's just so that people understand. I mean, this was 16 pages of an A3 document. I mean, it'd be familiar to Sam. I'm holding it up to her now, but this is one of the big A3 pages of showing consistencies with each of the attacks. So I would lay out each of the attacks. Page one, I had the crime report number, date, time, location of victim prior to the offence. Page two, location of the offence, age, ethnicity, occupation, clothing worn by the victim. Page three and four, method of approach, sexual acts, method of restraint. Page five and six, violence, closure, offender's physical description. Page 7 and 8, offender's clothing, other, theft. And page 9 to 16 was language. So half of that was about the language used in each offence, which was a very important part of linking non-DNA linked offences and showing really that this guy had a script. And my key consistencies within each of the attacks, I colour-coded, because as analysts, we love a good colour-code system, don't we, Sam?
We literally love it. It's our raison d'etre.
Yeah, we love highlighters. We love colour coding. So I've got green is method of approach. His was a surprise attack, but sometimes it would be confidence. Blue was sexual acts. Orange was violence. Yellow was closure. Sort of a more burnt orange was the offender's physical description. And the purple was other. So any other things that are similar or salient that are worth including. And there were a number of things within this series. And so each page has real detailed information about each case. And that was actually accepted at court that these offences were linked. However, Richard Baker pled not guilty.
Mm.
Now, a not guilty was really interesting to all of us. And we thought that that would happen. But it meant that it went to a full trial. And it meant that the victims had to give evidence. And I felt very strongly, and I went to court for one of the first preliminary hearings. I felt very strongly he was chancing his arm that some would not give evidence, but also that he would enjoy watching those who did. And that power
reliving
and control dynamic.
Experience.
Yeah. A fantasy-based offender. And that's exactly what he did. And I'll never forget, actually, there was a probation officer there, Sam, when I went to the one of the preliminary hearings, and he was sat where the offenders sit, and I sat there in disbelief watching her go up to him. She was an older woman. She patted him on the hand and she said, "All right, duck, you'll be okay, Richard." And she was trying to reassure him, and he sort of winked at her. And we all just sat there absolutely shocked.
Oh,
we knew
God.
That he had got her under his spell. He was a charismatic individual.
Yes.
Very ordinary looking. In fact, some would say good looking, right?
And what I'm widely reported in the media, you know, and it always just kind of stuck in my throat, this, you know, the media lead with good looking Richard Baker, you know, handsome. And you're just like, oh my God, he's a monster.
Yeah. And he was underneath it. I mean, I've got some of the headlines actually, which I'll read out because they're quite interesting. But this was somebody, the brother felt he had to stop him. We all felt the same. Right. You felt that, I felt that, the SIOs. We took a lot of pride in the work that we did, and it was really painstaking work. And we did get a result in that we did get guilty. We got guilty of 3 rapes, 1 attempted rape, 2 indecent assaults and a fray. And the sentence was 4 life terms of imprisonment, so 4 life sentences, and unbelievably a minimum of 12 and a half years. And that was in 1999, the minimum being 12 and a half years. Well, what we also learned was that he'd been in prison before. 6 years was his sentence in 1987 for raping a 19-year-old in Devon. So again, we've got that connection. That's where he was from. And he'd been arrested 5 previous times in the UK for rape, never been convicted of those other offences. And he'd been arrested in Spain multiple times, never convicted in Spain. And in fact, he would go to Torremolinos, where he was, you know, a DJ, and he would use alcohol. So again, a target-rich environment. I still remember, you know, being 13, 14, going to Portugal, going out to bars and clubs. And of course, the DJ was always the cool guy. You know, he had girls and women hanging around all the time. It's a perfect hunting ground. But he would use Rohypnol, we found out. In fact, 2 Swedish girls had been drug raped by him, and he was arrested for that. He claimed it was consensual, but when police cuffed him, he was in a property where the rapes took place. He was cuffed and he shouted to 2 other guys in that property, "Get rid of the jacket." And the police never followed that up.
Oh,
and he was released because there was no evidence to prove, and that the police said it was consensual. And it was the same story for a 17-year-old girl out in Spain. And I'm sure there were many others, because we knew that there would be hundreds. And in fact, the media did report at the point where we're looking for other similar offences, because obviously once he's convicted, it doesn't stop there. And you know that.
No, it never does.
And it depends whether there is investment in looking for other offences, or whether people just throw their hands up in the air and say, "Oh, well, we've got him on these. He's got 4 life terms," and don't do anything else. Well, there was a commitment to look at other offences. And in fact, this is a headline from The Express reporting on it. "Did this monster rape 100 women? As DJ Richard Baker faces a life sentence, police open victim hotline." And that's what we did. There's a smiling picture of him, and I'll post these pictures. He said at court, well, I want to read some of the things that he said, but here's one of the other headlines: "Pure evil. Police fear nightclub DJ may have raped up to 100 women." And there's lots of pictures of him with different women, looking respectable, brown, tanned, happy, smiley.
Do you remember about the Ted? Do you remember? And I'm sure Jackie, if she's listening to this, will remember the meeting that we had where we all first met. And we were looking through and looking at the statements. And in one, the victim describes him as fairly pale. And then there's the time gap, isn't there? And then he comes back, or the next victim describes him as really tanned, you know, to the point where she's saying like Mediterranean. And we were all like, the sun's been rubbish here. It's been, you know, because it had been like one of those really rainy, and all of us were like, we can't. And you know, and it wasn't, you're not just talking about a 2-week holiday tan. Do you remember one of the victims says, "Oh, it's like Mediterranean skin."
Yes.
And we were like, well, he hasn't got that here. So something's going on there. So we were already asking those questions of like, hang on a minute, why is there such a difference in the description of skin tone. And I can remember being in that meeting with you, you both saying, well,
is it the same guy?
Yeah, yeah. Is it the same guy? Does that explain the break with the...
So. And then we find out that he's going back and forth between Spain. You know, one of the things I wanted to share with you, this is from the Daily Mail, the 19th of May, 1999. So there's another picture of Richard Baker with a group of young girls in Spain. And it says, I know I need help, is the headline. DJ in sex case, not rape case, admits terrorizing victims for total control. Richard Baker admits indecent assault but denies rape. He added, I'm going to prison for a long time. Let me go to prison for the right reasons. I know what I've done and what I haven't done. It's not been rape, he declared as a group of his alleged victims listened in the public gallery. I know that I need help with what I've done, and I know that the only way I can get help is to start afresh. Described by the prosecution as a man with an inordinate sex drive, he told yesterday how he attacked two girls in a single night, one in Southend, Essex, and another one 6 hours later in London. Baker has confessed that he terrorized his victims because he wanted to be totally, totally in control. He has said that he would hunt for lone women aged around 20, assault them, and then make up stories about himself to put police off the scent. Yesterday, his own defense counsel called his actions depraved. And I just want to pause on that because I think it's really interesting the prosecution notch it up to this inordinate sex drive. And again, I just want to make the point, this isn't about sex drive. This is about, in his own admission, power and control.
Power and control, yeah.
I really take exception to when people say that this is something he can't help. And that's what he said to his mother, who I later found out was a magistrate. Did you know she was a magistrate?
I did not know that. No, I didn't know that. Wow.
And he said, I just need help. It's my sex drive. And that's what she believed. I mean, it's absolute nonsense. And the fact that he confessed that it's about total control and that he would drive down to Southend to the seafront, these are his own words. There were an awful lot of people, he said, I was feeding off it. Asked if he was hunting for victims, he replied, at that time of night, girls are out in short skirts. Yes, I was looking. And it goes on and on and on, him saying, but it's not rape. And it's really his defense counsel that call it depraved behavior, the prosecution. I mean, this isn't a sex case, this is a rape case. And I really hope people pay attention to that language. Yes, he went to prison, and I always tend to, every now and again, intermittently look at cases and see what's going on with them, because I knew he would be coming up for parole, as we saw with Colin Pitchfork and various other cases. And he did come up for parole.
Yes.
Didn't he? And it was denied on February the 1st, 2021. And I'm sure he'd be coming up for parole again soon. But in 2016, he was actually rearrested and an additional 6 years was added to his sentence for possessing and making indecent images of children.
Yeah, in prison.
Hundreds of them, Sam. Really horrific images. And he basically had hidden it behind a wooden picture frame in his prison cell. Now, if that hadn't been found, everything that was written in the reports about him was that he was a model prisoner, and he probably would have been allowed to be paroled. So he's spent an extra 9 years in prison. I mean, Judge Francis Sheridan got it right. He'd be a very old man before being released, if that ever happens. And I really hope that doesn't, because he is a sexual sadist. He's a psychopath. He is untreatable because he's a psychopath, very dangerous, very devious, very manipulative. And I'm glad that, well, we started work on the case. So September time, we had the meeting for the Linked investigative series where Paddy Tonks, it was decided it would go on Crime Watch November 30th. And by December, I think it was about December 18, he had been arrested.
December 16th.
He'd been arrested. And that really is a very successful conclusion to a joint investigation between a number of forces, which I'm very proud of the work that we did. And I always still feel it's incumbent to ensure that he never comes out again, because those who work the job know exactly how dangerous and devious he was, and that he cannot be rehabilitated, because psychopaths, there's no cure, there's no treatment for them.
The parole board has recognised that on this occasion, haven't they? Certainly saying any rehabilitation treatment that he's been through has been unsuccessful and he's shown no remorse.
Exactly, no remorse. Well, when someone says it's not rape and they repeat that it's not rape, that tells you they're not taking any responsibility for their behaviour. And when they put it down to their sex drive and so on. So, you know, then we've got child victims. What's that notched up to? You know, this is somebody who will always have a somewhat plausible reason for what he's done, that it's everybody else, but it's not him. And that's why it's so important probation officers, prison officers are really understanding of psychopathy and coercive control and just how devious these individuals are. It still is the stuff of my nightmares, you know, with no remorse, but he was dubbed a model prisoner, that he could have been released had they not have found all those images of children. So this guy will never stop. They don't stop until they're stopped.
No, absolutely.
Anything else you want to add, Sam, about...
Well, I just think it's a really, you know, this job, and it was a really early one for me. And, you know, obviously I'm hugely, hugely pleased that it brought me to you and, you know, the work and the discussions that we continue to have. But I did learn, you know, obviously I'd come from the serious crime analysis section where I'd got a background, but I did learn an incredible amount on this job that, you know, I took forward and took through my career. And to quote what we were starting to say at the beginning of the show is, we asked the right questions, and when we didn't get the right answers, we asked different questions and got the right outcome in this case.
Yes, and it's that satisfaction of getting the right outcome. I mean, most of us are not in it for the glory or the medals. We're in it to do a good job and be satisfy ourselves that we played a role in a successful investigation and operation, because often it isn't the crime analysts that get the accolades. And as I watch various, you know, TV sort of remakes, which what you see bears very little reality.
The
dramas are scripted, or, you know, where they write you out and it's a male SIO who gets the glory and the credit. Look, I'm all for people being acknowledged, but share the love. Come on.
Yes,
you know, make sure the crime analysts get some love as well, because we do incredible work, and it's important that it's a team effort where you all work together.
It absolutely is a team effort. But I think so often those really key points that are found through crime analysis that drive those investigations forward in a far faster, more efficient, more focused way, they just get lost, don't they, in the ether. And that's the analysts doing that. It's the analysts that are driving, that end up driving those lines of inquiry that can quite often bring the results. And we will always give a massive shout out to fellow crime analysts, but you are all incredible and you do an incredible job. And be proud. Be proud of what you do.
Absolutely. And you worked hard on this case, as were other analysts working hard to identify other offences. And it's that community of you being able to pick up the phone and talk to each other, as well as the forensic side, ensuring where there are forensic opportunities, that every forensic opportunity is fully exploited. And that, I still see so many cases where that doesn't happen, where you have to do a full-on forensic review. Ray Fyshe, who I work with in the Met and others, but he worked a lot of the linked investigations. You have to really understand sexual violence and abuse and the offender's psychology, and also what's possible in terms of forensics. I think one of the cases, I think it was one of the first times low copy number was used around forensics, where there was only a little bit of a forensic sample, but LCN was used successfully. I think I'm remembering that right.
You are remembering that right, yeah. First ones, wasn't it? And obviously that's gone on to develop hugely in its sophistication, and smaller amounts of material are being required now in order to get a DNA profile or a profile that can be grown into a bigger full profile.
So absolutely. You have to exploit all opportunities, don't you, Sam? You make your own
luck.
And you have to know what you're looking for.
You will say that there should be some very frightened offenders out there, because, the science and the analysts are coming for you.
Well, thank you, Sam, for joining me. It really has been a trip down memory lane, and what an incredible, painstaking and nuanced investigation it was. And it just shows what's possible even way back then in 1998. So, you know, it's triggered a lot of thoughts for me. And I know we're going to talk about another case where you were pivotal with a lot of the analysis, and I really want my listeners to hear that. So we're going to talk again. And I just want to thank you so much for your time and for your work. I really value you. So thank you.
Thank you so much. And it's been a pleasure, obviously, being on again and talking everything through with you. And it's just, you know, the whole revisiting of cases makes you realise what an incredible journey that we've been on. And I'm very thankful to you and all your learning and all your brilliance and the brilliant work that you carry on doing. So thanks very much for having me again.
Oh, thank you, Sam. I'm jumping in here to wrap this episode and series about Operation Monarch. I hope you found this conversation with Sam fascinating. You really are hearing some of these details for the first time. And there's a couple of things that I want you to think about before I wrap. Firstly, low copy number. I mentioned that it was used for the first time. Well, that was a new sensitive DNA technique, and it was first used in a case that Sam and I are going to share with you next week. The case was codenamed Operation Orb. And again, you're going to hear some fascinating insights and behind-the-scenes conversations about an operation that led to a successful conclusion. I also want to share with you an article that was written in The Job. Now, The Job was the Metropolitan Police Service's newspaper, which we all used to read. Now, the article is dated June the 25th, 1999, and this was on the front page of Volume 32, Issue 807. The headline was Teamwork Nets Wicked Rapist. Serial rapist Richard Baker has been sentenced to life imprisonment following a successful joint operation between the Met, Sussex and Essex Police. Passing the life sentence, Old Bailey Judge Stokes, QC, stated that the 34-year-old disc jockey would serve a minimum of 12 and a half years in prison for his offences, which included rape, attempted rape, indecent assault and defray. The judge described Baker as a plausible and practiced liar and decreed that he remain under licence for the rest of his life, registering with police wherever he lives in the future. Speaking about the sentencing, Met Commander Paddy Tompkins said, "I agree with the judge's sentiments. Richard Baker is a truly depraved and wicked man. This sentence means that women will be much safer." Commander Tompkins was in overall command of Operation Monarch, the joint investigation into Richard Baker's string of crimes. Launched by Essex Constabulary in 1998, the operation linked attacks in Southend with offences in Brighton and St John's Wood. The Met and Sussex Constabulary joined the investigation and officers worked together on the complex case, creating 988 documents and collating 552 statements. Their efforts led to the arrest of Richard Baker at Heathrow Airport bus terminal on December the 16th. Said Commander Tompkins, "Operation Monarch is an excellent example of police detective work and cooperation between police services." Lastly, I want to share a letter that I received through my ultimate big boss at New Scotland Yard, the Director of Intelligence, and the letter was from Commander Paddy Tompkins and Detective Superintendent Sean Sawyer. I've thought long and hard about whether to share this letter. I hadn't read it for many years, and I've never shared it with anyone before, but talking about this case with Sam, well, on reflection, maybe it's time to change that. And so I decided to share it with you lovely listeners. You know, throughout my career, I have received praise for my work, and I've also won some awards. However, I've also had to deal with an awful lot of nonsense, with some people saying that I'm a fraud, and actually write to others telling them that I'm a fraud. And I'm thinking about a male psychiatrist who was a really nasty piece of work. I know many other women who've experienced the same thing. If you don't say your credentials and roll out your CV or resume, you're a fraud. But if you do, you're big-headed or a narcissist, a word a lot of people love to throw around to try and discredit others. Rarely can women win, and I don't see my male colleagues being subjected to the same. Also, often women are rendered invisible in successful case outcomes, and often it's men who claim the credit on a public platform. And so I'm sharing that with you, and please watch out for it for yourself and for other women, because it's not okay. Okay, back to the letter. The letter was dated the 21st of December 1998, and it was addressed to Commander, let's call him Commander P. "Dear Commander P, regarding Operation Monarch, as you are aware, Operation Monarch is a multi-force investigation into a linked series of sexual offences. On the 16th of December 1998, Richard Baker was arrested, and as a consequence, other offences throughout the United Kingdom, Republic of Ireland and Spain are being investigated. He was charged with numerous offences, and a schedule of present charges is attached for your information. On behalf of Commander Tomkins, Essex Police and Sussex Police, I wish to pass on my sincere thanks to colleagues within SO11, in particular, Miss Laura Richards. The work of SO11 in bringing potential offences to notice has been discussed at the very highest levels within the Met. During the earlier stages of the inquiry, it was the experience, knowledge and energy of Miss Richards that focused attention on the potential scale of Baker's offences. At the time, there was little forensic evidence. Baker's identity was unknown, and he was not profiled within the DNA database. In addition, physical identification by victims was also, at that time, limited. Her work was then produced graphically, and in the early days of the investigation, drove many of the lines of inquiry. Miss Richards found herself in the unenviable position of having senior investigators from three forces and the National Crime Faculty looking for her expertise and attention to detail to deliver results. She more than met that challenge. In addition, Miss Richards was the most experienced analyst from the three forces, and therefore force principal analysts sought her advice and guidance in progressing their own analytical work. Her efforts in coordinating their activities has contributed significantly to the success of this inquiry. I am very much aware that the vast majority of her work was undertaken in addition to an already burdensome workload. Within a period of days, through painstaking comparative case analysis of literally hundreds of offences, Miss Richards identified six other offences within the Met. Her work will be used as part of the national circulation to all forces in order to identify other potential offences. Richard Baker has been charged with five of the offences identified by Miss Richards. In those cases, either identification by victim, fingerprint identification or DNA identification has become available since the work of Miss Richards. I understand she is still reviewing other potential crimes which may be attributable to Baker. I would be most grateful if you would very kindly consider passing on my warm thanks for the professionalism, commitment and expertise of Miss Richards. Yours sincerely, Sean Sawyer, Detective Superintendent. What a wonderful letter to receive, and I was extremely proud, and I still am to this day, of the work that I did and the work that we did as a team to identify this dangerous and violent man in the quickest time possible. I know that it gave the victims some comfort, respite and peace, and I hope that wherever they are now, that they're continuing to heal and to thrive. I know that we did our best. We did our best for them and to protect future girls and women. It's exactly why I do what I do. And I'm so thankful to all of you, my lovely crime analyst squad, who are on this journey with me. Until next time, be curious, ask questions, and always trust your instinct. Here's my final thought and ask before the episode wraps. I really appreciate you listening to Crime Analyst, and if you like what I do, please take 2 minutes to leave a 5-star review wherever you listen to me. It really helps others find me and my work, and it helps with the ratings too. Crime Analyst is written, produced and hosted by me, Laura Richards. Sound engineering by Jason Sheasley at Abridged Audio. Cover art and graphics by Chris Rowbottom at Syndicate, and music by Kilrood.